What did you think, or what did you know of Christopher Hitchens before you had met him?
Yeah, Christopher Hitchens, I'd read his book, God Is Not Great, lowercase g, very deliberately, God Is Not Great, How Religion Poisons Everything. And I had seen him in debate here or there. And, you know, the book is a rant, and often his presentations were rants, articulate rants, but rants. And I expected the man to match the book. And to my surprise, Christopher was a man who off stage was different than the man on stage. Not entirely, but in many respects he was. And the two of us immediately hit it off.
This was in Scotland?
This was in at the Edinburgh International Festival in Scotland.
And what happened?
He was scheduled to come to my hotel room. I had an especially large hotel room because we were setting up cameras and we were interviewing various participants in that debate at the Edinburgh International Festival, the largest cultural festival in the world. And I'm sure he'll hate me. I mean, I'm someone of the left, particularly of the, you know, sort of this, the crowd he liked to hang out with, the Manhattanite leftist group, would hate. I mean, what am I? I'm a white Southern evangelical. Worse, I'm a suburbanite. And I just know he's going to hate me. And I'm pretty sure I'm not going to like him either. It comes the knock at the door. I open it, and he spills forth into my room as though we're continuing a conversation we'd had earlier. And he said, this was the news of the day at the moment, the British army has effectively capitulated at Basra, and the Archbishop of Canterbury is calling for the adoption of Sharia law. Whatever happened to a Church of England that actually believed in something? And I said, Christopher, you sound like a man who's nostalgic for a Church of England that actually believed the Bible. And in that moment, he had been looking out the window, his back to me, and he wheeled and he smiled with a kind of touche sort of look and said, perhaps I do. And from that moment on, I thought this is going to be an interesting relationship.
Well, you describe Christopher Hitchens as having two books, essentially. Yes. That there was a public persona and then there was a private persona.
Yeah.
And we think about that split with a lot of people who are in public life.
Yeah.
Was there something different about that split for Hitchens?
Yes. I do a lot of, you know, CNN or, you know, MSNBC the other night and that that sort of thing. And often what you discover is that, yes, that the big personalities are a little different off stage or away from the cameras. But Christopher, speaking of himself, he spoke of himself this way, as a man of two books. And it's a metaphor, not a metaphor he invented, but it's a metaphor he uses a lot in his memoir, Hitch 22, in which he said that, we're all divided selves to some extent, but it's particularly strong in my case. And the metaphor, two books, is a reference to a kind of fraudulent bookkeeping, that there's the, you know, the Enron's public accounts and the books that everyone sees, and then there are the ones they don't that tell the actual balance. And this is what Christopher meant, that there was a public manifestation of himself and a private manifestation of himself. And I discovered that the public manifestation of Christopher was everything people thought that he was. He was, at least until 9/11, he was the leftist, sympathetic Marxist, a fire-breathing atheist. But something went off in Christopher after 9/11. Christopher, this is all public, by the way. This is all quite substantiated. After 9/11, Christopher broke with the left politically. This was his first conversion, if you will. He broke with the left at a political level and said, look, I can no longer go along with the knee-jerk leftist position that America deserved 9/11 and deserves all, is responsible for all the evil things in the world. I'm not doing it. These people are terrorists and we need to kill them. I mean, that was, if you read Christopher's writing in this period, up until he died, this was the narrative. But then, ironically, with the publication of God Is Not Great in 2007, Christopher, won some favor back with people on the left. They're like, this is the Christopher Hitchens we know. Here he is again, you know, railing against all things religious, Christianity, and no less than anything else. And as part of his promotion for that book, he told his publicist, he told his publisher, I want to debate people of every religious stripe, any religious stripe. Well, Muslims didn't take him up on that, and Hindus did not take him up on that. Some Jews did, but most of all, it was evangelicals who tilted against him. And so the first time in his life, Christopher was interacting with evangelicals, and he discovered that they weren't all that the caricature of them had portrayed them to be.
And so how do you read that fraudulent two books narrative? Is this just something that came because he was forced to get into the sort of nuance that these issues sort of bring?
I think that Christopher, you know, for atheists in this audience who are perhaps right now ready to slit their wrists at the thought that their hero, Christopher Hitchens, wasn't what he seemed to be. I don't mean that Christopher Hitchens on stage, when he was saying all that he was saying in support of atheism, that he didn't actually believe that. Christopher Hitchens was an atheist. Rather, what I'm suggesting is that Christopher on stage would give you the impression. I mean, for instance, with my debate with him, he would give you the impression that he had equal disdain for all religions. That's just sheer nonsense. And it led many of his fans to the conclusion that Christopher hated all religious people. Not so. The very first time I met Christopher, he spoke backhandedly of celebrated evangelical Christian and geneticist Francis Collins. Well, before he died, Christopher would refer to Francis Collins as one of the greatest living Americans. Why? Because Collins had become his personal physician. Christopher was making distinctions offstage that he wasn't making on it. And so, you know, this was typical of Christopher. Christopher was an actor, and a good one. Christopher had a kind of training in debate that he knew that part of winning a debate isn't simply the words you speak. It's the presentation. It's the tone of your voice. It's facial expression. It's speaking with conviction and certainty, perhaps even about things that you're not very certain about. And Christopher did this a lot. And so in our debate, you know, Christopher is railing against all things religious, and the Christian faith is this and it's that and so forth. And when the debate is over, he crosses the stage, we meet each other in the middle, shake hands, and he says, "You are quite good tonight." And then he turns, and we look at looking at the audience, it's giving a standing ovation, and he says, "I think they enjoyed us very much. Are we still having dinner?" And meaning that Christopher judged a debate as a performance. Here in Birmingham, I moderated a debate between him and David Berlinski. Christopher wiped out Berlinski in that debate, and I mean no offense to David when I say that. David is as close to a Renaissance man as I've ever met. He writes beautifully. He has an extraordinary intellect. But I don't know if it's because David was reticent to go after a man who was dying. I'm not sure, but David was rather quiet on the stage that night and just absorbed Christopher's blows. But if fans loved that, Christopher didn't. And the reason Christopher didn't is when that debate was over, he knew I was disappointed. And I wasn't disappointed because I want to see Christopher wiped out. I wanted to see a good debate. You know, I don't want to see a first-round knockout. And Christopher was disappointed, too, because he didn't want to let me down and because he knew that it was kind of a bust in the sense that, we had an opportunity here. And so during the debate, he tried to bring me into the debate. So Christopher was a performer in this sense.
A good portion of the book centers around two long car rides that you had with him, road trips. How did those road trips come about?
Yeah. This book, The Faith of Christopher Hitchens, which, by the way, I have to say this, Andrew, it's a pretty remarkable. I could never expect this again with anything else I ever write. It has not only been endorsed by, say, Eric Metaxas, the New York Times bestselling Christian author, Ravi Zacharias, a well-known speaker, but I was on Hardball three nights ago, and Chris Matthews said this book is beautiful and that everyone should read it. It's a beautiful story of friendship. And the friendship in the book, The Faith of Christopher Hitchens, centers around, I guess you'd say the climax of the book, is our car rides together, our road trips. One reviewer called it a buddy book, a buddy story. and a kind of a male equivalent to Thelma and Louise, which I've never seen, but I read that in a review. And we were driving from his home in D.C. to mine here in Birmingham, Alabama, 751 miles in one day. Not difficult for me to do. I've done it many times. In fact, I did it just a couple of weeks ago. But Christopher was, at this point, he had been diagnosed with esophageal cancer, and he was emaciated, hairless from the radiation and so forth. He was a sick man, but he wanted to do this. And I had challenged him here in Birmingham. I think it was in Ruth's Chris Steakhouse, place he liked. I challenged him to a Bible study. And I had, because Christopher would, you know, we would be after a debate or after an event or before one or whatever, we would be debating, talking. And Christopher is saying all these things about the Bible. I said, Christopher, you are always saying these things so confidently. And as somebody who knows the Bible, I can tell that you don't. I think you've cherry-picked it, and you've strung together all these unrelated facts in order to put God in in this blackest narrative. I challenge you to a study of the Bible, where it's not my opinion or your opinion. It's, well, what does the text say? So here we are, driving from his home in D.C. to mine here in Birmingham, and before we leave, he's about to get into the car, and he says to me, playfully, he says, Larry, did you bring a copy of St. John? You know, I do actually own a copy. And I said, no, I've actually got one, but that's okay. And so here we are. Andrew, you have to picture this. This is the stuff almost of Monty Python. Here I am, the Southern Evangelical, driving through the Shenandoah Valley on a beautiful fall day. Christopher is sitting in the front seat of my car. He has his reading glasses perched on the end of his nose, a Johnny Walker Black Label Scotch squeezed between his knees, and he's reading aloud from the Gospel of John. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. And then he would stop, and we would discuss that for a little while. And I was somewhat anxious because it was, I forget, Veterans Day maybe. State troopers were everywhere, and I thought, you know, if you talk about open container, we have mixed drinks and so forth in here, and enough Johnny Walker in the back for a battalion. And I don't have any Bible studies you've ever attended where scotch was served, but this was my first, and it was highly entertaining.
Yeah, well, apart from the scotch, what was that discussion of the Bible in that private environment? What was that like versus other Bible studies that you may have led or may have been involved in, particularly with evangelicals who already are in your camp, so to speak?
Yeah, you know, I kind of specialize, Andrew, what I do for a living is speak with people who don't agree with me. So this wasn't that much different than any discussion I've had with a student at UAB who might be an atheist or an unbeliever. On an Ivy League campus or in a coffee shop in the Midwest. It wasn't especially remarkable in that sense. For me, and maybe I'm unique as a Christian in this, I much prefer speaking to groups of people who are reasonable, thoughtful, but who are inclined to disagree with me. That makes for a more thoughtful discussion. That, to me, makes it more interesting. I don't want to be on TBN. I want to be on MSNBC's Hardball. Last year, I went on Al Jazeera and debated a well-known Muslim cleric, and those in your audience who are atheists will know Daniel Dennett. That, for me, is a great deal more interesting. And so with Christopher, I didn't find his questions threatening. We weren't arguing. He was asking really good questions, the kind of questions Christians might ask. I mean, questions like, hey, okay, I get it that grace came through. This was a comment he made in a question. I get it that grace came through Jesus. That I get. I can see that in the person of Jesus. I see grace in the New Testament. But Larry, where is grace in the Old Testament? I mean, it seems like a different God in the Old Testament. Explain that. And I thought, hey, great question. Let's unpack that a little bit.
I believe it was during this section of the book, but Christopher Hitchens submitted this idea of Protestant atheism.
Yes.
Can you explain what's the idea
That's
behind
right.
that?
Yeah, well, Christopher had decided, you see, any Catholic or Greek Orthodox listeners in this audience who think his views softened towards those institutions, I'm sorry to disappoint you, they didn't. Christopher Christopher hated the Catholic Church. He hated Greek Orthodoxy, and it was because he saw them as power structures. What his view of this pope would be, I have no idea. But evangelical Christianity, he was intrigued by, and it's because at the bottom of evangelical Christianity is a kind of protest. You know, the term Protestant is a result of the Diet of Speyer in 1529, when the people protested the practices of the church, and they became Protestants. And Christopher saw something admirable in that. So for him, Thomas More would be a villain, and let's say William Tyndale, who translated the Bible into the vernacular and was burned at the stake for doing it, Christopher would see him as a hero. I mean, because the Protestant Reformation was driven by people who, like him, were protesting an oppressive religious power structure and were endeavoring to put the Word of God in the hands of regular people. So for Christopher, this idea of Protestant atheism, what he saw in Protestantism, it was this fundamental thing that he admired, a protest against tyranny, against oppression. And he played around with this idea of what he called Protestant atheism.
Well, taking a step back, the story certainly has an element of, hey, look at these two guys.
Yeah.
Don't agree with each other at all, but hey, they get along.
Yeah.
But ultimately, the two of you stay on the same sides of that divide. What do you take away from that, given that it doesn't have that element of perhaps redemption from your perspective, or just simple resolution?
Yeah, you know what I think is funny, Andrew, and slightly annoying, is my Twitter has, after an appearance on MSNBC, which was mild, and or an appearance on Rick and Bubba or here, is that there are those who have not read the book who are ready to trash it because they think this is God's Not Dead. You know, that's what I've done here, is I've set up the Christian as the champion and the atheist as the loser who is vanquished by my clever arguments. Read the book. There's a reason why Chris Matthews loved this book. There's a reason why Michael Shermer, well-known atheist Michael Shermer, loved this book, as well as Christians. And that is, it is as a best-selling author Paul Reed puts it, an elegant, honest account. I'd make no Lady Hope of Carradine-like claims regarding Christopher Hitchens. Lady Hope claimed some 32 years in 1915, 32 years after Darwin's death, that Darwin converted. And there was no evidence of a conversion. And Carol Blue, Christopher's a wife, an elegant woman, she was there, and she said that she saw no evidence, heard nothing come from his mouth that would suggest a conversion. I believe Carol. I think she's a credible witness. I think that the whole of my claim in this book is that Christopher was a man of two books, that offstage he was very different, and that after his diagnosis with esophageal cancer, a diagnosis, Andrew, that he knew to be a death sentence, Christopher was reevaluating his religious options. Greek Orthodox, no. He was never going to consider that. Roman Catholicism, no. Judaism, perhaps. He was deeply affected late in his life by the discovery that he was Jewish on his mother's side, something that his mother had kept secret the entirety of her life. But Protestantism, evangelicalism, had a kind of appeal to Christopher, and he was exploring it. But I think the problem for him, Andrew, was that Christopher had created a kind of prison for himself. I mean, if your reputation is built on, just as mine is in the other direction, if your reputation is built on atheism, and you have spent so much of your life in discussions like this one, and on television and so forth, railing against faith, it's pretty hard to backtrack from that and to admit that perhaps you're wrong.
So is it enough just to be that honest tale?
Well, I think so. Douglas Wilson, who had a relationship with Christopher much like my own, says this book, The Faith of Christopher Hitchens, is a beautiful yet melancholy tale. In the end, I don't tell a story that has this neat and tidy ending. And that's because the story itself doesn't have a neat and tidy ending. For me, it was enough. Christopher was somebody I cared about. I readily admit I wasn't prepared to care for Christopher. I didn't think a relationship would be there. I would see him at an event, see him say, you sit here and you sit here, and it'll start in a few minutes, and we'll go at it, and we'll see you later. But Christopher came to be somebody that I did care about. And I think, Andrew, that was something that mattered to Christopher, that at the end of his life, he knew I was pursuing his soul, not as a trophy, not so that I could, you know, could lay claim to him in some way, but because he'd come to matter to me, and because at the end of the day, he knew I truly believed that there is a God in the next life to judge us for our actions in this one, and that has either good or bad consequences. And so Christopher was prepared to allow me that opportunity to share with him. And so I have a chapter in the book that I think kind of summarizes our relationship that I call 310 to Yuma. And in that chapter, for those in your audience who might have seen that movie, whether it's the old one or the new one, I would always liken our relationship to that film. What's your relationship with Christopher like? Well, have you ever seen 310 to Yuma? He's like Russell Crowe's character in that film, Ben Wade, and I kind of play the role of the rancher of Christian Bale. What started out as my mission to get him on that train, so to speak, oddly became our mission. He was helping me to get there.
This may piggyback on that just a bit. How has this friendship changed you?
That's a good question. I think for me, things that I took away from this are that, you know, just the a reminder of that which is so important if you are a Christian, or even if you're not, but specifically as a Christian, the data says that most Christians do not share their faith in Jesus Christ with other people. A celebrated atheist and illusionist Penn Jillette made the comment that, you know, if you're a Christian and you believe there's a heaven and a hell, how much do you have to hate somebody to not tell other people about that? How much would you have to hate me not to tell me that? And then he goes on to say, I don't respect Christians who don't seek to proselytize. And I find those words very convicting from somebody who doesn't share my faith. And so for me, it underscores the importance of, I think Christians have, in this country, unfortunately, confused their faith with a political agenda. And I think that doesn't mean that as a Christian I don't have political opinions. I have strong ones, and I vote with relish. But that said, I think that when Christians do share their faith, they often, not always, often confuse it with a political platform. And at the end of the day, that's not what the gospel is. It's something that's very different. I mean, I'm reminded of the fact that Jesus Christ drew people of every political stripe to himself. Zealots, Romans, Jews, Gentiles, everybody. And that the Christian faith isn't just for the social conservative. It's for others too. And I wanted to make clear to Christopher, Jesus isn't mine, so to speak. Everyone has free and equal access to this man, and I think you've mischaracterized him, Christopher, and I hope to persuade you to reconsider.
Larry Taunton is the executive director of the Fixed Point Foundation. He's the author of The Faith of Christopher Hitchens. Larry Taunton, thank you so much.
Delighted to be here.